Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at your pets and your pets' care today on the Ideas Network. Welcoming back Dr. Bill Stork. He has been with the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic for over 25 years, works with both small and large animals. Also an author of three books, writes a blog, and contributes articles to local newspapers, so he's a busy guy. We'll be talking about the importance of getting your pet enough exercise in the winter and how to avoid separation anxiety. So, are you concerned about your pet getting enough exercise? What pet care questions do you have? And pet health as well. Join in. Give a call at 800-642-1234. Or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Dr. Bill Stork, welcome back. Good to have you with us. Oh, you know what? We lost Bill. Well, I'll tell you what. We'll be getting Bill back. I'm pretty sure of that. In the meantime, think about the kinds of things that you might want to ask Bill as we visit with him, and I'm sure we'll get him back here. You see, we can talk about plans for getting our pets outside for exercise. I was thinking about a friend who got a dog, and the dog was a little out of shape, and she happened to be leaving for a vacation, which was almost 2 weeks. It was about 11 or 12 days. So she left the dog with me. And I would take Lila out in the morning when I did my three-mile jog. And then at noon, I'd take her, after the radio show, I'd take her out again for a mile or two. And then in the evening, I'd take her out for another 2 or 3 miles. And we did that every day. And she was a tired dog. By the end of the vacation, and when she came back, when my friend came back, she looked at her dog and said, "Whoa, my gosh, she looks a lot better. She's lost weight." She lost a couple of pounds during the time that she was gone. So a good exercise routine for my friend's dog paid some dividends. And we have Dr. Bill Stork back with us, so let's turn to him now. Hi, Dr. Bill.
Good morning, Larry.
It's great to have you with us today. I was just talking about exercising a friend's dog and what an impact it made, and this was in the summertime. Of course, now we've got winter coming on. It's nice out there now, but we need to get our dogs out for some exercise, and I expect socialization as well.
Well, which is exactly the point, because back in May and June and even in April, a very common thought we had was, my God, we're going to walk our dog's legs off, because up and down Main Street in Lake Mills, Wisconsin, I'm pretty sure wherever we went, the dogs were ready for a break, because the only thing people could do was walk their dogs. Well, I'm driving those same streets in the same town, and as the light disappears, I'm pretty sure there was a day last week when it didn't even get daylight, and according to the calendar, it's going to keep getting colder, and in direct proportion or inverse proportion to the thermometer, we see a lot fewer people out walking their dogs, and dogs need physical exercise and mental stimulation, and yeah, socialization, at least as much as in the wintertime as they do when it's more comfortable for us to be outside. And especially this year more than others, and if we find ourselves in need of content later on, we'll circle back with how this year relates to dogs that have been at home with their families since March and April. Some of the things that we talk about used to be in exam rooms, now in the parking lot at the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic, is exactly what you said. There is no such thing as bad weather, just a poor choice of clothes. And people who hike and bike have a pile of polypropylene and fleece and Gore-Tex and gloves and boots. And this is a phenomenal time to get ready to use them. And, you know, it takes a little motivation when you come home from work and it's dark and you leave for work and it's dark, or even for everyone who's been at home, you know, they're working from home, they have kids in school, and, you know, the plan is to walk the dog as soon as you get a chance. And that chance doesn't always come. And like any other thing that needs to be an urgency, I recommend that people, one, put it on the schedule. I mean, you're going to take the dog for a walk at noon. You're going to take a dog for the walk at 7:30 in the morning or 7:30 at night or whatever works in your schedule. And some of the implements this time of year that become pretty important is a light, for example. And my wife loves to make fun of me. I have a headlamp that becomes kind of my wardrobe standard this time of year until the daylight turns back around in the spring. And for our dogs, so they can be seen, there's all kinds of harnesses and lights and leashes and things like that. So when you're walking outside, you can be seen.
Yeah. You know, we had a cold snap in the Madison area and other parts of the state as well here last week, I think it was. Anyway, I immediately noticed a lot of dogs with coats and sweaters on. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, when does a dog need a coat or a sweater?
Well, some of that depends on the dogs. I see some of those dogs wearing coats and sweaters who would rather be outside anyway. And obviously it depends on the breeds and the condition. And the more sparsely coated breeds are going to need it sooner than others. And, of course, that's going to be dependent upon, are they used to being outside a lot? The wind makes a big difference, just like it does for us. I think there is no temperature by which a dog needs to wear a down jacket, but to a large extent, if we're uncomfortable, then they may be as well. You know, yeah. If they're pit bulls with not a lot of hair or smaller breeds with not a lot of hair and not a lot of flesh.
Yeah, and you know, I think about paws from time to time. What about paw coverings? I can't imagine that it would be nice for some dogs. I know the dog that I was walking probably would not want to have paw coverings and would immediately take them off.
Could not be more correct. And paw coverings are a real deal in a couple of situations. I have an Australian Blue Heeler who was Australian Shepherd Blue Heeler Cross. It was born in Montana, Wyoming. She would take a nap on top of a snowbank. But when it gets below zero and the pavement gets really, really cold, that's a, for instance, when paw coverings become really, really valuable. The other time when paw coverings get to be really, really valuable is when there's a lot of salt out, and the salt could get wedged in between their pads. And you are also very correct with dogs are famous for a number of things, one of which is not liking to have their toenails trimmed and not tolerating boots on their feet. And like a lot of things, we'll recommend that people condition the dogs to them before it's time to go for a walk out in the cold. And also, a little bit like trimming nails and things like that, there's a lot of positive rewards and distractions that you can use to get them used to it. One of the tools that we use at our clinic, and I'm sure lots of other clinics use, is a busy bowl. You take a bowl and smear it with whatever is that dog's favorite. Could be canned food, peanut butter, squeezed cheese, Charlie Bear's freeze-dried liver, and feed that dog that busy bowl while you're in the process of trying on the proverbial Red Wings. And and when they allow them to be put on their feet, then you reward them for it.
There's a paw wax. Dr. Carrie Donahue, who is on the show once in a while, has a paw wax that she's kind of, you can make up yourself at home. It's almond oil, coconut oil, shea butter, and some beeswax.
Yeah, beautiful. Musher's wax is another commercially available product as well.
Yeah, we put a link on our program notes to an article Judith Sears Poisson wrote a few years back, and it has the recipe for the wax. So if you go to ideas at WPR.org/Larry, you can find that recipe for Carrie Donahue's paw wax. So anyway, that can be a help too. And you know, what really happens to pets when their exercise levels drop?
Well, much like ourselves, there is the physical condition. It gets really difficult to maintain strength and body weight when you are less than active. And beyond that, there's also, you alluded to earlier, the socialization aspect of it. People will so frequently build a fence in their backyard, some will choose to use an invisible fence, and it's just so much easier to turn the dog out in the backyard and let them do their business and bring them back in. But what they lack in a situation like that is stimulation, because dogs take in their world very largely through their nose. Dogs can smell with greater detail than I think all of our senses combined. And the example that I use quite frequently is, you know, we wouldn't go out and buy a Sunday newspaper and then read it for 6 months. And that's kind of what it's like for your dog, who just goes out back, does their business, and comes back in. There is enormous value, and veterinarians will speak frequently about what we call a long sniffing walk. Go outside, walk down the sidewalk, sniff the surroundings, meet the people who are out, and we'll recommend that people take a different route, different sidewalk, start from a different spot as frequently as they can. And it's kind of like sending a kid to school who's made to sit in a chair and read and listen. It really engages their mind. And the world's greatest living, or one of the world's greatest living blues men and storytellers, Charlie Parr from Duluth, Minnesota, in an interview once upon a time, he was talking about recovering from his own potentially career-ending surgery by walking his dog. And he said, "Our walks became infinitely more interesting when I let the dog walk me. And I simply followed the dog. I had to explain to a few of my neighbors why I was walking through their backyards and their garages. But the things that we saw."
Yeah. Wow. That's a great, if you could get away with that, that'd be a great, that is a great idea. Dr. Bill Stork, our guest today. Great to have him with us to talk about a lot of things relating to your pet's health. We've been talking about cold weather care with him, but we'll take other questions as well, and you can join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller, Jill Nadeau, our producer, Tyler Ditter, our engineer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your pet's health today, Larry Mueller here with my guest, Dr. Bill Stork. Dr. Bill owns and operates Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic, works with both small and large animals. Certainly, he always enjoys talking with you, and I hope you'll join in with your questions as we move along today. Number to call, 800-642-1234, email at ideas@WPR.org. And let's take a call. Kathleen in Delavan, it's your turn. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for all the tips.
Sure.
This isn't about that, but my tiny Chiweenie does wear a coat for sure and hoodies. But my question is, my mixed breed eight-year-old dog was just diagnosed with Addison's disease. And I wondered, is there, I know there's an oral form of the Percortin or a similar type of thing she needs, rather than the injection every 25 days. It's hugely expensive. Is it safe, or are the vets still giving them the oral form, even though I know it needs to be taken every day along with the prednisone?
Yeah, complete medical management of Addison's disease, and management is a better word than curing or treating, as you have found out by now. In most cases, depending upon your dog's specific blood work, potassium in particular, it's usually going to require the Percortin injection once a month, or once every 25 days, as it turns out. A lot of us, based and guided by blood work, will attempt to gradually diminish that dose of Percortin. But by my understanding, in the cases that I've treated, those dogs respond much better with the injectable Percortin per month.
There you go, Kathleen. Thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. Barb and Maribel, your turn. Hi, Barb.
Hi. This goes back to your talking about walking dogs. And
yeah.
I heard once that for a dog, a walk is like reading a book. Every sniff is a page, and every new little area is a chapter. And
beautiful.
I think of that a lot when we walk our little 16-year-old rescue schnauzer. Anyway.
Wow. Thank
so
you, Barb.
We love it.
Thanks, Barb. Well, isn't that a great thought?
That is beautiful. A client once told me, Bill, have you ever thought about going for a walk without a dog? What's the point?
And for the dog, it's like reading a book. You know, every smell is a page. I love that. That thought. Thank you again, Barb. Well, Pam in Superior, it's your turn. Hi, Pam.
Hello.
Hi, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I've got a 12-year-old beagle, and he's overweight, has been all his life, no matter what we've tried. We've given him beans and carrots. He's still just overweight. Anyway, he has a collapsed esophagus, and he used to just cough maybe once or twice a day, but now he's really coughing a lot. So I've been giving him Benadryl and Robitussin. Is there anything else I can do?
Well, first of all, with regard to a 12-year-old overweight beagle, I will say that I'm pretty sure they can extract calories from packing peanuts and sawdust. So I admire your effort on attempting to keep his weight down, but we understand. The other thing is there's a bit of a distinction. You use the term collapsing esophagus. Is this perchance there is collapsing trachea, there is laryngeal paralysis, and then there is mega esophagus. Does perchance, when he eats, is that difficult for him, and does that make him cough?
A little, but mostly it's when he puts his head up and...
And is a beagle?
Yeah. Like, he'll put his head up if he hears the refrigerator open or anything, or if he lays flat on his stomach on the kitchen floor because it's hard.
Yeah, yeah.
And he sounds like a goose honking, and then he goes, bleh.
Yes, indeed. That is some combination of collapsing trachea and laryngeal paralysis. And unfortunately, there's not a really straightforward treatment for that condition. I've heard some anecdotal things that may be somewhat effective, but yeah, I mean, what you're doing is what you can do and make life as easy on him as possible.
Pam, thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. Vicki in Mondovi, on to you now. Hi, Vicki.
Hi. I have a golden retriever. He is about 3.5. And he's a red golden. I don't know that that makes a difference, but he is itchy, really itchy. And I, you know, the first year we had him when he was one, he had like hot spots, and we had him shave him and all of that. But he doesn't have that. But we brought him to the vet several times. She tested him for mites. It was negative. And we treated him anyway, but it didn't help. Well, I've tried an oatmeal bath. I've tried a bath from the vet, an expensive one. He's just itchy. And down by his skin, you can even see like little like scabs almost like, I don't know, like psoriasis kind of, but he's just itchy and he's miserable.
Yeah, and as they are extremely miserable, the skin is the biggest organ in the body, and there are times when we have to treat the whole darn golden retriever. And he read the book as far as age and breed being itchy, because they're one of the most common breeds that we find skin conditions in. And my tagline is that if it weren't for itchy dogs in the fall, I would have to take up golf or go back to fishing or something like that. We see dogs like yours very, very frequently. So lots of things come into play when we treat these dogs, and when they have itched to the point of having hot spots and things like that, then oftentimes that comes to involve antibiotics and antifungals to get the infection under control. As well, we have to reduce their need to itch, and therein lies the challenge. There was a day when we used to have to use steroids like prednisone on these dogs, and no one is fond of the side effects of steroids. We've moved beyond steroids, and there's a couple of products that we gravitate to that aren't steroids, and the side effects of those drugs are more from the standpoint of the owner, because they're more expensive than steroids were. But have a tendency to be very, very effective. One is called Apoquel, and the other one is called Cytopoint. And those drugs are effective in about 85% of the dogs that we use them in. But skin is a condition that has a tendency to be managed more than cured. And what we say is that, you know, next year, hopefully, he'll get some relief when the snow flies. But we try and treat them about 10 days before they're about to start itching, because the less damage to the skin, the more effective we can treat them.
He is itchy all year long. Sometimes they're worse than other, but it's okay. All year long. And I actually do have him on prednisone. I give him a small tablet every other day, because it's the only thing that makes him livable. But he's still itchy. He doesn't itch till, you know, he bleeds or anything, and he doesn't have hot spots, but he just has these little tiny scabs kind of everywhere, and he's itchy. I don't know what to do to help him.
Well, as you can see, these things get complicated in a hurry, and they are multifactorial. And I'll stop by saying I don't usually recommend doing allergy testing, but this might be a case for allergy testing. It's not inexpensive, and it's not straightforward, and it's not the panacea, but dogs who itch year-round very well might benefit from that. So you might ask your vet if they're familiar with things like Apoquel.
Apoquel. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Good luck, Vicki. Thank you very much for calling. We will turn to Pat in Wauwatosa next. Hi, Pat.
Hi. How are you?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
We have a 6-year-old chocolate lab who is a breeder rescue. We've had her for about 2 years, and she's been doing fine. She wasn't housebroken when we got her, but we housebroke her, and she's been doing fine. But then during the summer, she will not, up to the summer and now, she will not go out for her last time at night unless you go out with her.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and if you don't go out with her to make sure that she's done her business, then she can't go through the night, and then she has an accident in the house. So, you know, she'll go out during the day, she'll do her business, but the 10 o'clock going outside, she'll go outside, but she'll just sit at the door. She won't do anything.
Yeah, so, you've got to go with her, Pat.
Well, reward. In situations like this, what we will advise clients of is to kind of rewind, even though you have a 6-year-old lab that came to you at 4 years of age. Sometimes we don't know what those dogs have been through on the front end. And my what we advise people is that you have to make that an absolute business trip, in which case you're probably going to have to gear up and go outside with them. And when they go to the bathroom outside, make sure you reward them for it. Whatever her favorite treat is, freeze-dried liver, peanut butter, Charlie Bears, whatever it is that she likes, so that she is rewarded. And the other thing that you don't do in a situation like that, and I get the impression you probably won't, is you don't go out and play ball or throw Frisbees, which 10 o'clock at night you're not likely to, and you don't go for a social walk. It's a business trip. And when she goes to the bathroom, she gets rewarded, and then she gets to come back inside. And if she's, I hate to do this to a six-year-old dog, but if that doesn't work, then sometimes we have to rewind all the way back to the crate and put them in the crate for a period of time until we can get this situation under control.
Yeah. And those treats, I'm remembering Dr. Patricia McConnell's comments on this. Those treats need to be given pretty much immediately after the dog goes.
Absolutely. Yeah. So yeah. There's a direct association. And also another excellent point, Larry, you don't get to give the treat when the dog comes back inside, because then the dog is being rewarded for going outside and coming back in, not for going to the bathroom. It has to be, the association has to be crystal clear that the dog is being rewarded for going to the bathroom outside.
Yeah. Pat, good luck. Thank you for calling. Gary in Clinton, Wisconsin, your turn now. Hi, Gary.
Hello.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Well, I have a question about joining two cats together that have never lived in the same house. And there's obviously some conflict and some territorial things going on. And then I have a comment to Doc about the passing of Jerry Jeff Walker, which I know he and I will both lament. So I will leave
yeah.
it at that.
Beautiful. All right. Well, with regard to joining cats together who don't necessarily want to live in the same household, an option would be to build another house for the other cat, because, and that's not to discourage you, but just to say that sometimes these things can be super challenging. And I bet that you've done a lot of the obvious things, like keep them separated by a physical barrier, like a wall so that, or not a wall, a door, so that they can be aware of one another under the door, and change bedding between the two of them, and then you progress to a gate, though most cats can climb the gate. Sometimes we will recommend that the new cat starts off in an enclosure, like a cage or a crate, and the incumbent cat can investigate. Another tool for inner cat disagreement that can be very valuable is called feel-away multi-cat. And feel-away multi-cat is a pheromone product that those of us who listen to people like Jerry Jeff Walker might think that this is hocus-pocus medicine when you start talking about pheromones. But we have, in the course of our practice, seen some situations where in objective blinded studies, if you will, we have seen pheromones work, and they are available in plug-in diffusers that you, and they'll cover about 600 square feet. So in the room that you want these cats to be able to commingle, you use a feel-away diffuser.
Yeah, and that can work. And I'm remembering years back we had introduced a new cat, and we had to keep them separated for about 6 months.
Oh yeah, yeah. Sometimes it never works. I've known households that had cats that came home together, and in 12 years they were never in the same room.
Oh boy. There you go, Gary. Thank you so much for calling. By the way, you can join in, too. A question about your cat, your cat's health. I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Let's go to Judy in Little Chute next. Hi, Judy.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have a 10-year-old, part coon, part chocolate lab, who is getting very stubborn as he ages. He goes to the dog park. That's fine. But on our walks, he likes to plant his paws and sniff where he wants to sniff. And it doesn't matter if it's in the middle of a crosswalk, in the middle of somebody's driveway. He doesn't care. And I've had people get out of their vehicles and help me move them to the other side. And treats don't work. And words of encouragement don't work. And I don't know what to do with the little boy.
Good boy. Well, and which brings a topic that we encounter a great deal and something we continue to learn more about. We talked about it last time I was on the air. And that is aging pets and some of the very special considerations with regard to aging pets. They, much like aging people, have a tendency to get a little bit set in their ways. And they don't deal with change the way they once dealt with change. And then there are potential medical underpinnings of things, like, for example, mobility. And we have found on multiple occasions that sometimes a behavioral symptom can have underlying medical issues that can help. And if your dog isn't on supplements for mobility, glucosamine comes to mind, turmeric comes to mind, fish oil comes to mind, or possibly even at that age, we will sometimes resort to anti-inflammatories that simply help them move better. And this also evokes the Charlie Parr example. You know, life gets more interesting when you follow the dog. There must be something there that's interesting.
But when they stop in the middle of the crosswalk, it's a little bit difficult to do that.
Well, if you live in Clinton, Wisconsin, like Gary McAdams does, it's not that big of a deal. It might start a conversation. But if you live, you know, in Chicago, then it's a little bit of a different deal.
Yeah. Judy, good luck. Thank you for calling. Marge in Menominee, it's your turn. Hi, Marge.
Hi. I have a 12-year-old husky, and the last couple of years, she just gets so warm. It's been difficult in the summer. She lives in the air conditioning over the vent, and she loves this kind of weather. But she pants, and the vet can't figure it out. She's just so warm. She can maybe make it a couple of hours, but if the temperature in the house goes above 67, 68, she's so uncomfortable. She started sleeping in the garage and, of course, going outside in the daytime.
Yeah, and I assume that your vet worked that situation up, in which case no drastic changes in her appetite, in her weight, and no abnormalities in her blood work and things like that.
She's been consistent with her weight, and the blood work has turned out negative.
Yeah, and this is going to seem like a question from left field. I bet she's spayed. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay, yeah. And no coughing, no difficulty breathing, aside from the fact that she's working harder to thermoregulate when it gets warm.
Yes, yeah. And she has challenges. And she was a rescue dog, so yes, she was neutered immediately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Man, I don't think it sounds like your vet has worked this up thoroughly, and this may be a situation where we have to come her way and provide a cooler environment for her.
Yeah. What else can there be? Thank you very much for calling, Marge. Appreciate it. Two in Whitewater, it's your turn. Hello, thank you for calling.
Hi. I have a couple of comments. Doctor mentioned Apoquel as a possible, treatment, and I guess it works a lot very well. However, there is some suspicion that it can cause autoimmune disease. My daughter's dog just ended up with autoimmune, and that's one of the the main, they're suspecting upper quill more than anything else. And boy, I'll tell you, that's a problem. Secondly, there was the person called about the dog that no longer wants to go outside at night, but is fine during the day and used to be okay all the time. Again, my own experience, that's happened with our Australian, and he has gone blind in one eye and somewhat almost blind in the other, and he doesn't want to go out at night unless you walk with him, because I think he cannot see. He's perfectly fine at every other time. Anyway, just those comments. Yeah.
Thank you for calling. Thank you very much, too.
Beautiful point, and we made the assumption that he was able to see okay at night, and that wasn't part of the reluctance. With regard to the side effect from Apoquel, if years of practice have taught me anything, it is always to read potential side effects. And every drug has benefits. Every drug has potential side effects. And we very much pay attention to those. And as is the case with anything, we have to weigh the potential benefits versus the potential side effects. And we also have to sort through those things very careful. And yes, autoimmune disease is on the list of potential side effects as a result of Apoquel. But very frequently, these potential side effects have to be listed not necessarily as causative, but associated with. And there's some real intricacies as we evaluate those. And that discussion might be beyond the scope of even the Larry Mueller Show.
Okay. Two, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Frank in Lake Mills, your turn. Hi, Frank.
Hello.
Hi, what can we do for you?
Is this the Baron von Storkmeister?
Oh, for goodness sakes. Vote for Frank. Just when you think you're out of options next Tuesday, here, my friends, is your answer. Frank, what can we do for you?
Well, I would like to know about, some suggestions you could give on keeping your dogs happy and active during this lockdown and winter, because we, as a group of people here being responsible and trying to limit our activities, that happens to our dogs as well. And then they're getting kind of cabin fever. And so what do you have suggestions that we could do in order to keep them a little more happy and more calm?
All right.
Well, there's a segue when you needed one or not. And that gets back to something we were talking about on the front end, Larry. When COVID came down the line and everybody was walking their dogs, that was great. And many people were coming home with COVID puppies. And one of the things that we preached to COVID puppies was please, please, please make sure you expose these guys to all of the things that they might be exposed to in real life, assuming that real life will come again. And I'm still hopeful in that regard. And now 6 or 7 months on, we're starting to see dogs who have been home with their owners for 6 and 7 months at a time, dogs who normally, when mom and dad went to work, would call for the remote control so they could click on and watch the Ellen DeGeneres Show at 10 o'clock. Now, when mom goes to the mailbox to get the mail, the dog tries to eat through the drywall to get outside, developing separation issues. So what Frank is alluding to is the ever importance of keeping these guys stimulated. And if you live where Frank does, he can go walking down Crossman Road and meet all his neighbors out back, dog parks. We're surrounded in Jefferson and Dane County. We have all these public hunting grounds might not be a great option for the next couple of weeks. But dog parks are a wonderful opportunity to take your dogs off for them to put their nose on the ground. And as the earlier caller alluded to, like reading a book is a wonderful option. There are also some things, because there will be times when it's icy outside, when the wind chill is in the double digits below zero, or the footing isn't suitable to go outside and walk on a sidewalk. And that's when things come into play. For example, busy bowls, busy balls. There are food distribution tools that we will use to make mealtime more interesting for the dog. Instead of just eating their meal in a bowl, they have to roll a ball around on the floor to get the food to fall out. Or they can get their calories from a frozen Kong. You can put food in a Kong, top it off with leftover mashed potatoes or canned food, and freeze it. Then they have to work for their meals. We have clients, and this one I can see Frank and his wife doing at home, who will play hide and seek with their dogs. Teach them to sit and stay and go hide in your house. And adults and kids alike will play hide and go seek with their dogs in the house. I've yet to see a dog, although I'm pretty sure there are poodles who could learn the game of chess more quickly than me. But there are some options to keep their minds and bodies working. And it's going to take some creativity. It's going to be a long winter.
Frank, thanks again for calling. Appreciate it. Dr. Bill Stork, our guest today. He's been with the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic for over 25 years as the owner and operator, where he cares for pets great and small. Join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at your pet's health today with Dr. Bill Stork of the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic. Great to have him back with us. Join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Bill, a listener emailed wondering how to keep dogs from getting ticks. They live in Marathon County, and ticks are everywhere. All of their dogs, as well as humans, have had a tick illness. Some have been very sick. Hard to even walk them or just let them out of in the cut yard. Any ideas?
Oh, you bet. Ticks are real, and especially when you get into Marathon County, because some 2-year-old research says that somewhere in the vicinity of 50% of deer ticks up there are Lyme positive. So the answer is, we have a tendency to approach these dogs in multi fronts, because up there we powerfully recommend the Lyme vaccine, because there was a day when the Lyme vaccine was almost as rugged as Lyme disease, but like a lot of things, the vaccine is much safer and much more effective than it's been before. And then comes the products, so to speak, and I had an associate once upon a time, Dr. Deanna Clark, who worked really hard to try and find a more naturopathic approach to flea and tick prevention. And she is someone who hiked and skied with her dogs, and she ended up using the quote-unquote products. Frontline is the name that lots and lots of people use. Frontline has been around for a very long time. And when we see breaks in protection, it's oftentimes Frontline. It's just been around a while. There are products like Vectra is one that we use, which is a topical that you apply one time per month that has a tendency to be very effective, kills them either on contact or before. And there are orals. And by name, one of the products that we have gravitated in the direction of is called Bravecto. And we started using this product about 4 or 5 years ago against my will, because I couldn't stand the name of it. And I didn't like the fact that you only gave it once every 12 weeks. Well, in spite of the fact that Dr. Stork doesn't care for the name, Bravecto has resulted in us seeing somewhere in the vicinity of 125 to 150 Lyme positive dogs per year. And so far in 2020, I think we've seen about 25 Lyme positive dogs this year.
Wow. That's quite a difference. There you go. Thank you for that question. Mary in Dorchester, Iowa has something for us. Mary, hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
We have a rescue dog that is actually part Australian cattle dog and believe it's part lab. Came up from Texas, but this dog will not under any circumstances let you try to clip his nails. They've tried everything. Or take him to the vet, and we gave him like sort of a relaxer type thing that we got from the vet before we took him in, and we had to up the dose before we could take him in. He's just, I don't know what it is with him. I mean, you know, he's a really good dog. He's very well behaved, but as far as someone trying to actually manhandle him, as it were, he just is, I mean, he'll fight it. He doesn't bite or anything, but when they finally got him to the point where they could actually do a blood draw to check for heartworms before he got his heartworm medication, he actually urinated everywhere. So I'm at a loss. And I'm afraid he needs his teeth cleaned, and I don't know how to get him there, because I'm assuming they'd probably do blood work before they would put him under to clean his teeth. And I don't know how that would work.
Okay. Lots in that question, and you answered a number of questions that I might have. Lot going on with a dog like that. First of all, we've got genetics, and an Australian cattle dog is a really smart, active, purpose-driven dog. It is not in the least bit uncommon for dogs to not like having their paws handled, especially not having their liking to have their paws handled and have their nails trimmed. This is not going to be, there is no short-term answer for this situation. And what it will require is kind of one of two different routes. For a dog like this, you can either commit to a lifetime of sedated nail trims if his nails need to be trimmed that frequently, if he grows nails that have to be trimmed. Some dogs, you can walk them on the sidewalk and they will wear them off on their own. Because if you resort to physical restraint, you will eventually push him to the point that he will bite, and each time the struggle will be greater. And especially when you mentioned that he urinated on himself, that's a sign of extreme distress on that dog's part. Another option is if you have qualified trainers in that neighborhood, and I'm sure you do, to find a rewards-based trainer who can take an extremely long period of time to teach you a series of association exercises, one of which we call touch training. And the long and the short of it is you eventually learn to reward the dog to allow his paws to be handled, and eventually you work up to having his nails trimmed. It takes a very long time. It takes an enormous amount of patience, and it takes a pickup truck full of treats, and you may or may not be successful in that regard.
Yeah, and someone, you would need to work with someone who really knows what they're doing in terms of training, right?
Absolutely. On our website at the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic, we have videos, and we have videos of the process of touch training, but you're not there yet. When you describe a dog that gets anxious at approaching the veterinarian, what we've had dogs like that, we've encouraged clients to come to the clinic for a social pleasant visit. They come to the clinic, they park in the parking lot, they go home. They come to the clinic, to the parking lot, we go feed them treats. Eventually they make it to the front door. Eventually they come inside. And you get the point. We're attempting to develop an association, a positive association. And any attempt at physical restraint can undo that. and any attempt at oral sedation that you can give at home in order to, quote unquote, take the edge off of them, they will burn through that the minute you touch their paws every time.
Wow. So it sounds like Mary's got a bit of work ahead of her.
And injectable sedation for the nail trim. Otherwise, things will get drastically worse in a hurry.
No. Mary, I'm sorry. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call very much. Well, our guest today is Dr. Bill Stork. He's been with the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic for over 25 years. The owner-operator cares for pets great and small, and is the author of a couple of books, soon to be three. He writes a blog and contributes articles to local newspapers. It's great to have him with us today. As he was talking about a dog's nails, I was reminded of an article in his new book, or a piece in his new book, about working with a dog with those kinds of nail problems. And we'll talk with him about that on November 17th when we talk about his new book. In the meantime, though, you can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. We'll take a quick look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with Dr. Bill Stork. You stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your pet's health on the show today, Larry Mueller here with my guest, Dr. Bill Stork, owner-operator of the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic and works with both small and large animals. Also an author of three books, he writes a blog and contributes articles to local newspapers. So he's a busy guy, but here to talk with you about your pet's health. What questions do you have? Give a call, 800-642-1234, email at ideas@wpr.org. And let's take another call. Michelle in Prairie du Chien, it's your turn. Hi, Michelle.
Thank you so much for taking this call. I have a cat who has had a somewhat elevated creatinine, I'm not sure I said that right, number in her blood work, since she was 3.5. Highest her blood work's ever been is 2.7, but her last blood work was 1.9. And she gets daily fluids because she doesn't sub-Q that I give her, because she doesn't do as well when she doesn't have them. But she also doesn't seem to be doing as well as expected with that number. She's doing like somebody with a higher stage kitty would be doing. She doesn't like to eat. We've tried so many foods. She's been tested for pancreatitis. I guess I'm just wondering, although her blood work looks fine other than that number, if there's anything else we should be looking at.
You told me how old she was. Is that correct?
Well, it started when she was 3.5. We first noticed this number. She's currently 9.
Okay. And how long have you been giving her the subcutaneous fluids?
At least a couple of years. There was a span of time where I gave it to her when she first we first noticed this when she was really young, but then she seemed to bounce back and was doing better she was okay without it. But now we've been doing it now pretty consistently for quite a while because without it, I myself was in the hospital and she didn't have it for a few days and she just went downhill. She didn't have her fluids.
Oh, boy. Well, first of all, I admire your persistence and her tolerance. And you say you struggle to get her to eat, and I assume that she is also gradually losing weight?
Well, she's been steady right now. She's just a touch over 7 pounds right now. Mm-hmm. We've had her on mirtazapine. But I'm a little nervous about it. She goes a bit nutty on it. And I try to use it like as sparingly as I can, like every 3 days.
Sure.
Little piece of it, half of it.
Okay. And throughout all this, you mentioned her creatinine was somewhat high and that she's not doing as well as her blood work. I'm under the assumption that the rest of her blood work is relatively normal.
Yeah, everything's looked good. The only other thing that's ever popped up is sometimes her liver number, and I think it's because of lack of eating and at various times, and then she would be on Denisil for a while, and she'd kind of be back from that.
Yeah, well, these conditions we call loosely nebulopathies, meaning they're the cases that have a tendency to elude most of our diagnostic modalities, for example, blood work, because you pointed it out yourself, creatinine, that's not necessarily a high creatinine, and I take it that her BUN and phosphorus are also relatively normal, which are other kidney enzymes that we look at. And I'm sure your veterinarian has done radiographs as well. So then when the answer for an underperforming cat does not show itself in the basic in-house diagnostics like x-rays and blood work, then we go looking for some more advanced diagnostics. There are other tests. For example, we call it a gastrointestinal panel that's looking for a large condition that's roughly defined as inflammatory bowel disease. But clearly we could spend hours just on this case alone. You've spent years on this case alone. But what I will say is that as you graduate to each level of more aggressive diagnostics, you're in the area of diminishing returns, in an area of not necessarily finding a black and white cure for the situation. What I will say is you're awesome in giving the fluids and have probably contributed to her having the 5 or 7 years of quality living that she may not have otherwise had. So nicely done.
Yeah. Michelle, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Elizabeth in Sheboygan, your turn. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, gentlemen. Thanks for having me on. Dr. Bill, I have a question for you about a puppy that I recently adopted. To give you a little bit of a backstory, a few years ago I adopted a dog from the Humane Society who turned out to have canine brucellosis. We did decide to keep her and do a lifetime quarantine, and we do get inspected by the state vet's office every few months. A couple months ago when the state was calling to set up an appointment, they just happened to mention off the cuff that they had just found a cell of brucellosis in an Amish puppy mill. And they had one last puppy that they were getting ready to euthanize. And I said, oh, wait, can I just take it? You know, I already have a dog. She's already under quarantine. We'll take this puppy, knowing literally nothing about it, except for that it had the brucellosis. We've now had him for about 4 or 5 months. He was born in January of last year. He is what the breeder was calling a teddy bear breed. So he's small. What I'm calling about is he seems to have leg or joint problems fairly consistently. I mean, he's always limping on one leg or another. It's never always the back. It's never always the front. Sometimes it's a limp and he's a puppy. He'll be running around and it doesn't seem to bother him. And some days he cannot walk. Within about 4 or 5 days, he'll be okay, and then give it a day or two, and he's limping on another leg. I'm wondering if you think this is the brucellosis, or if you think it's just poor breeding, and what I can do about it.
Well, first of all, I admire your heart in being willing to take in a dog with brucellosis and a dog that could have potentially been exposed to brucellosis. And I'm very confident that the state veterinarians have advised you fully of what that all means, in the sense that brucellosis is also a zoonotic disease, which means it can be transmitted to people and they can become infected, and especially people who are potentially immune compromised. So I'm confident that you've been informed of all of those issues. That, with regard to the puppy that has intermittent lameness, intermittent weakness, reluctance to move, boy, that's one that defies telephone medicine, and that's one that requires the laying of hands, x-rays, blood work, et cetera, et cetera. That one we're going to really have a hard time getting close to, especially when you introduce the variable of potential exposure to brucellosis.
Yeah. Is it possible? I mean, will veterinarians see an animal in that condition?
Oh, sure.
All right. So Elizabeth needs to see a veterinarian and gets some real look into this really carefully.
You bet. And that's very definitely a big picture situation. That's going to require palpation and x-rays and a complete workup.
All right. There you go, Elizabeth. Good luck. Thank you for calling. Kay in Milwaukee, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. I am so excited that you were on Dr. Stork. My pets and I used to be patients of yours when I lived in Lake Nose on Springer Road. We had the two donkeys, and I had a rabbit with a crazy condition he took care of once, and our dog. It's great to hear your voice on here.
For goodness sakes, Kay, I wish we could see you, but it's glad to hear you.
It's great to hear your voice. It's been so long. I just wanted, I heard earlier, as you probably remember, we had a dog that we had adopted that was, we found out, sadly, was not socialized from puppy on. And so when you were talking about the COVID dogs and people getting COVID dogs that they adopt and so on and so forth and keeping them busy, we had great training. If anyone is in that area, I don't know if you still do training with Missy or I know Nancy was involved at one point. I mean, I can't say enough about your vet clinic. It was absolutely fabulous. I miss it terribly. But so did lots of training through you guys. And Charlie is very, very food motivated, thank goodness. And we do the Go Find It, where you take, you know, little treats that are their favorite little treats. And he's very smart. He's a dachshund. And so he's super duper smart, super duper nose hunter kind of thing. And we hide them around the house. And as he got used to it, we just got places that were harder and more difficult for him to find. And then we also had a Boston Terrier that lost her sight to, I can't think of it right now when the eyes go foggy.
Oh, cataracts.
Yes, thank you so much. And so she was not very big with her nose. She was more sight. But as she lost her vision, she really got into that game as well. So using her nose when her eyes started to go was really a great way to change her from, I can no longer see the ball to go chase, which was her favorite thing to do, to giving her something else so she wasn't so bored. I just wanted to make that comment for people who are looking for ideas. And again, awesome to hear your voice. If I ever swing through, I will stop in and say hi.
Oh, that'd be awesome, Kay. And thanks for the echo because, you know, for the Carhartt and Coverall demographic out there, playing hide-and-go-seek with your dog might sound like a little bit fluffy. And, you know, you don't have to tell your neighbors or the guys down at the parts store that you're doing it at home, but it's real stuff to engage those dogs.
Thank you, Kay. Appreciate your call. Louise in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Louise.
Thanks for hearing me out. I have a 14-year-old female Samoyed, great physical shape for her age. However, she pants only on walks and only when she's walking. She stops panting. Could be cold out, so it's not like she's overheated. And the other thing is she just chews excessively on herself. So to remedy that, I give her a bath more frequently than I really like for someone of my age with Pyoben because of those properties seem to really stop the itching. It's been suggested, and I give her antihistamines, 50 milligrams, some olive oil and coconut oil, a teaspoon a day, a dollop of yogurt. It's been suggested she has Cushing's. Then the next vet said, no, she doesn't have Cushing's. Is this panting harmful to her? She doesn't pant other than when she's walking. And how this itching is just, it hurts me so to see her chewing like that. And the bath will stop but for 3-4 months, and then she starts it up again.
Well, it's incredible that you can bathe a Samoyed to the point with a Pioban and get a meaningful bath and a meaningful cleanse. And if you're getting 3 to 4 months out of a Pioban bath, then that honestly is more than what we can expect. That's awesome. Second of all things are relative. If you have a 14-year-old Samoyed that you're still out there walking with, I would be dancing a jig. That is positively awesome. As far as panting when she's walking, I will tell you that motion is medicine, and you may have to adjust the length and the rigor of your walks, but I would keep her moving and take as many breaks as you need to. We had a client around Lake Mills, Wisconsin, I still miss her, her cane doubled as a little stool. So when either she got tired or the dog got tired, she'd just stop and sit. And more times than not, someone would stop and talk to her until the dog settled down and away they go. But another thing to very much take into consideration is that panting can be a sign of discomfort. That's a physiologic potential manifestation of discomfort. And if you're not doing some of the joint supplements that we talked about before, or an anti-inflammatory to help her move a little bit better, it may be something to take into consideration. But nice job on all fronts.
Yes, thank you very much for calling, Louise. Appreciate it. And Nick in Green Bay will give you a chance. Hi, Nick.
Hi, I've got a question for you. I've got two dogs. I've got a little black and white one. And when we got them from the Outagamie Humane Society, they said, oh, yeah, this is going to be a medium-sized dog, but this is a small dog. And they said it was a collie, but it's definitely not a collie. But anyways, we got that dog, and then we got a black lab. And about a month ago, they came in from outside, and they play really rough. And the little white one thinks he's a black lab, so they play really rough. But he came in, and his eye, like, it looked like his eye was rolling in the top of his head. But I looked online, it's just his third eyelid. And They said they thought that it might just them playing, the lab might have got him in the eye, and you know, that could be the cause. But what's your hypothesis?
Has this persisted? Is it still the case, or did it come and go quickly?
It comes and goes. Like, some days you look at him and it's completely fine. And I went to Petco and got some eye wash just to make sure that, you know, eye washed out and stuff. And he likes it. He goes nuts after I do that. But it doesn't seem like it's getting any better.
Okay. Well, situations like these and most situations we look at on the whole. And when you look at the eye, you need to look at the area of the white area around the eye to see if it is nice and white as compared to injected with the blood vessels and gorged, as would be the case in an eye that was angry. In the area around the eye, we call it the conjunctiva. If that area is swollen and angry, that's a significant sign. The other thing, and a very big distinction when we worry about eyes, is the presence or absence of a corneal ulcer. So when that third eyelid is down and you're able to look at the cornea, it's really important to look very closely and see if there's any evidence of a scratch or any opacity, any haziness on the surface of that eye. And if in doubt, your veterinarian will stain that in search of a corneal ulcer. And if all of those things check out, if the eye is otherwise calm, then yes, there are some subtle neurologic issues that can result in that third eyelid being pulled up sometimes. So those are questions to be answered so as to ensure that that eye is safe.
All right, Nick, good luck. Thank you. Norman in Wausau, your turn. Hi, Norman.
I'd like to ask your guest if he knows what we can do about a very great 3-year-old German Shepherd who whines all the time about everything. Whines when he wants to go out, whines when you come home, whines while he's in the house if he needs to go out sometimes. I don't know why he's whining. Gets up on my legs when I'm sitting down and whines, looks at me and whines. And it doesn't seem that there's anything consistent that he's whining about.
Oh, boy. That's a big one, man. Well, the first thing that I would, the first approach to this situation would be the entire last 90 minutes. Everything we've talked about with walking and engaging are going to be really, really valuable in order to provide this dog physical and mental stimulation. And I have a sense that we're going to get the red light here in a minute that says we're near the end of our time. But I've seen situations like this, and one of the things that you have to absolutely positively do is when he whines, your job is to absolutely positively not reward him for it. You reward him for silence when he is not whining. And if, for example, he is sitting in his food bowl and he whines for food, and you give him food, you've just taught him to whine for food. And if he whines to be petted, and you eventually give in, you have just taught him that eventually you will pet him if he whines enough. Not to mention, we also talked about the medical aspects of these situations. But I have a sneaking suspicion that this is a dog that is potentially a little bit anxious. You have, once again, a very intelligent, high-drive, purpose-driven dog. And, you know, people talked about doing nose work, sniffing work. There's a dog that needs a job. And I've kind of talked myself in a circle, but your dog needs a job and a good job, a herd of sheep to watch over, sniffing work, whatever you can provide for him. It's going to require some engagement on his part.
All right. There you go, Norm. Thank you. Rick and Holman, do you have a quick comment? Oh, we lost him. Teresa emailed that she takes her dog to Farm and Fleet. They allow dogs to get her some exercise and socialization. And she said quite a few stores do this. I don't know where Teresa lives, but not a bad thing once in a while. If you know that the company or the business allows dogs, good idea. Bill?
And many do. And not to mention the fact that it's a really good excuse to go to Farm and Fleet, which
a lot of people like to do. Well, Dr. Bill Stork, I want to thank you so much. You're back on the 17th of November, and we'll talk about your new book. So looking forward to that. I'm having fun reading it right now. Thank you so much for being with us today. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Larry, very much for all you do.
Dr. Bill Stork, owner, operator of the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic. And we'll have him back again, I'm sure, to talk about your pet's health. Next, though, he'll be talking about his new book that's coming out. Well, tomorrow we'll talk about forest fires at 11. At 11:45, we'll take a look at Wisconsin's urban and community forests. In the meantime, thank you for listening, and please do stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network.